Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Maggie Mullen. Today on the show, we'll explore trainings for school employees and even students who might encounter someone with a gun in their school.
My own kids are there, and I'm not going to stand there and throw a book at someone who's trying to kill our kids.
The long-awaited upgrade to the UW College of Engineering has been completed, and officials say it's a game-changer.
I think it puts us on par with the kinds of facilities that you would see at places like Stanford or MIT.
The Wyo Theater in Sheridan turns 30 and is celebrating its place in the community.
The Wyo is actually the gem of the downtown.
Join us for those stories and more on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Maggie Mullen. We will begin our program with a pair of stories from our Mountain West News Bureau. From more intense wildfires to prolonged droughts, climate change is impacting the ecology of the American West. That's got researchers in our region looking at a new way to fight some of these impacts: drones. The Mountain West News Bureau's Noah Glick reports.
Adam Watts is a fire ecologist and professor at the Desert Research Institute in Nevada. We're looking at a video from a recent prescribed burn in Utah.
And now pretty much the whole screen is filled with alternating fire and black from the smoke. And it's really a hellish, otherworldly scene. And you just can't imagine being in something like this.
Watts was observing the fire with a team of researchers to learn more about how fire and smoke behave in large fires. They'll use that information to improve the models firefighters and land managers use to fight fires. But he says there's a limit to what they can learn at a prescribed burn.
We want some really big fires that are kind of like simulated wildfires. We don't want a little tiny prescribed burn, because if we study those prescribed burns, we don't get the kind of fire behavior and smoke movement that we see in wildfires. And that's what we're after the understanding of.
Researchers are a common sight at prescribed fires, but Watts' goal is to eventually get data from large wildfires. And he now has a tool for that. You see, the pictures and data collection from the video we were looking at earlier came from unmanned drones. That means he was able to get insights from locations he couldn't get to before.
Right over the flames, right in that column of smoke coming up from a fire where you just can't get a manned aircraft because of the safety, obviously.
And that's important because new perspectives can give scientists different information. For example, Watts is looking into whether microbes from soil can be transferred from one region to another by wildfire smoke. But to measure that, he needed to put scientific equipment right into the smoke. And that's a challenge because this equipment can be big. Some can take up the bed of a pickup truck. So to get it onto the drone, Watts and his team had to fit it all into something the size of a cigar box.
This emphasis on miniaturizing and specializing instruments and getting them in the air to observe natural phenomena applies to so many different things that relate to the atmosphere, water, and terrestrial ecosystems.
Drones are a new tool in a variety of ways, from fire suppression to land surveys to environmental information gathering, and for dealing with drought. Watts is also part of a team that has been testing drones for a process called cloud seeding. Theoretically, that can help mitigate drought impacts by flying aircraft up to the clouds and releasing silver iodide, which can help produce more precipitation. Science has yet to reach a consensus on whether or not the process actually works reliably, but climate change is making all sorts of ideas more palatable. Ira Sanchez Lugo is a climate scientist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. She says increased temperatures from climate change bring a rise in extreme weather-related events.
You know, what we were expecting was to see more intense and frequent heat waves, more intense and frequent drought in some locations. The general rule of thumb is the wet areas will get wetter, the dry areas will get drier.
This is a business opportunity for drone producers. Mike Richards is the president and CEO of Drone America, a Nevada-based company. He says he started his business to help with search and rescue operations, but it's since evolved to include ways to help mitigate the impacts of climate change, like a longer and more intense wildfire season.
Some of the work we've done with power line surveys actually helps with that, because you're identifying faults which could arise in a spark and then a brush fire, which as you can see, has turned into some pretty horrible results in the past.
As wildfires and other natural disasters overwhelm communities, Richard says drones can be used to more safely, quickly, and reliably get medical supplies and help to people in need. Imagine drones delivering first aid kits or life vests to people during Hurricane Katrina.
So what you would do is have them positioned strategically around known disaster areas, such as, you know, that area of Louisiana, for example, where the flooding and high storms or hurricanes, etc., can cause massive flooding.
Richard says Drone America was recently awarded a 5-year contract with the Department of Interior to gather and provide data on wildfires for agencies like the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Noah Glick.
You might not know it, but there's a branch of the U.S. Department of Agriculture whose job includes killing wild animals to the tune of millions each year. It used to be called Animal Damage Control. Now it's simply called Wildlife Services. As Allie Budner reports, depending on who you talk to, the agency is controversial and secretive, or well-managed and essential.
I meet Samantha Brueger and her tiny dog Genghis Khan to walk a trail that wraps around a reservoir in Pueblo County, Colorado.
So we are actually looking at a beautiful lake area.
Brueger is with the environmental nonprofit Wild Earth Guardians, and her work right now is mostly trying to figure out what Wildlife Services is up to in this area and in the state.
Because Wildlife Services operates under the radar so often, it's really hard to pin down exactly what they're doing and where.
The agency's self-described mission is managing problems caused by wildlife. Sometimes that means dispersing birds at airports or managing invasive species, but often it means they kill wild predators on behalf of livestock ranchers.
We're in an area where they might be doing this kind of thing.
Through a public records request, Brueger says she just found out that Pueblo County has a contract with Wildlife Services that's current through this year, and that 9 other Colorado counties had contracts as recently as 2016. But again, she doesn't know exactly where. What she does know is that Wildlife Services uses a variety of methods to kill animals that are deemed a problem. They use snares, traps, gunning from the ground, gunning from the air.
And then they also, in their contract, specifically state that they're able to use sodium cyanide bombs.
Those are also known as M44s. They're spring-loaded devices that release sodium cyanide, a lethal poison to canines and other mid-sized animals, including humans, at the right dose. The agency uses them across most of the West as one of its killing tools, mostly to target coyotes. And the practice is controversial. In 2017, an M44 was responsible for the temporary poisoning of a 14-year-old boy in Idaho and for the death of his dog after they stumbled on one on public land behind the boy's house. Critics have called for a ban on M44s, and that's under review by the EPA. Peter Orwick, though, is fine with M44s. He's director of the American Sheep Industry Association, and he says predators are a serious issue.
We have to live it every day. It's not just a talking point for our members. They are out there on their land interacting with the wildlife and livestock every day of their lives.
Orwick says dealing with predators is the second largest expense of most sheep ranches. He says he knows lots of ranchers who've invested in guard dogs and guard llamas and other non-lethal methods of keeping predators at bay. And he says they work, but they don't work in all situations.
And they still need the ability to have a trap or a snare or an M44 available to take care of a predator.
He says that's when a rancher has to call Wildlife Services.
I think the agency does a tremendous job.
No one from the agency was available for an interview, but a spokesperson pointed me to the agency's website, where she said, quote, "You can find information on our program, from federal allocated funds to what's given in cooperative funding to how many animals are euthanized and by what method, both intentionally and unintentionally by state." She also said the reason they can't disclose which counties, agencies, or entities they contract with is because that information is protected under the Privacy Act and the Farm Bill. Carter Niemeyer is familiar with those guidelines. He worked for the agency for 26 years.
We were the hired gun of the livestock industry.
But over the years, he says, the work started to feel futile.
In spite of killing thousands of coyotes every year, there were thousands more the following year to replace them. There had to be better ways to protect livestock.
He finally left the agency. Now, his feelings about wildlife services are mixed. He says on the one hand, they do a bloody job that no other agency is willing to do.
You know, the old sayings are like, you can't sell death.
And he believes that partly explains their lack of transparency.
They've become a very low-profile program. They almost have to hide out, so to speak, and some of the responses that involve lethal, though legally, they respond under kind of cloak and dagger.
Still, as a government agency, he feels they should be more open with the public, even if that means taking more flak. According to its own reporting, Wildlife Services killed more than 2.6 million animals in 2018, roughly 6,500 of those with M44s. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Ellie Budner.
When we come back, I'll take you on a visit of the new UW College of Engineering building. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Maggie Mullen. The University of Wyoming has opened its new engineering education and research facility. The $105 million project is being touted as one of the most advanced learning facilities in the nation and will not only benefit students, but the state and community as well. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck has more.
This is the Drilling and Completion Simulator, which is a state-of-the-art hands-on lab where students can learn just about everything they need to know about onshore and offshore drilling. The room is overseen by Tawfiq El Shahabi. He is of the Department of Petroleum Engineering, who tells me to put on some virtual reality goggles.
We have a virtual reality, a drilling rig virtual reality tour. And many of our students maybe never made it to a drilling rig or to the oil field, we take them to a virtual tour.
And there I am, somewhere in Wyoming, looking down from the top of a drilling rig, triggering my fear of heights.
Wow!
Everything you see makes you believe you're in an oil field, and way down below there's equipment, trucks, and it's all scaled to actual size. When you turn or look up and down, it's like you're actually at the rig site. Across the room, he's got another state-of-the-art simulator, and that is one of only two in the world that gives students a hands-on lesson in drilling operations. El Shahabi says the simulator has completely changed how he teaches. He says they can actually do everything someone can in the field in a laboratory setting.
Split them into teams, and every team will be trying to drill it fast and efficient. Then as an instructor, I'll be evaluating the results and giving them an immediate feedback. Same thing with the wireline and all the other simulators.
Before you had this simulator, how would you teach that?
Just showing them some pictures and lecturing, which active learning is more efficient than passive learning.
They also have an offshore rig that teaches students how to operate drilling operations at sea. That is also a state-of-the-art simulator. El Shahabi says UW has always had a good petroleum engineering program, but now it's beyond that.
This simulator here will put the university at the top when it comes to oil and gas industry, because this is the only simulator that looks like this in any other school.
And he says when you consider how affordable UW is, this could really grow their program. Engineering Dean Michael Pishko says that was certainly the goal when upgrading the engineering building was first considered about a decade ago. He says lawmakers, Governor Dave Friedenthal, wanted to take the program to the next level and help improve the ability to perform important research, education, and workforce training. And it's not just about oil and gas. Pishko says the new facility allows for active learning or hands-on approaches to teaching and learning, and it has other features.
We have a very large student innovation center, which is a makerspace. And so this is a place where students can design and fabricate what they're thinking of. So that could be anything from parts for an electric Formula One car that we have students working on to projects to help out high school and middle school students.
Makerspace coordinator Tyler Kerr says his facility is like an ultra-cool shop class.
A tinkering discovery area where we teach people how to use a lot of emerging technology that they might not have access to at home.
The highlight is 3D scanners and printers that allow people to print out actual hands-on projects. For instance, you could scan a skull from a faraway place and then print the actual skull out to be used in a classroom. They'll be offering how-to classes for students and the community. Another program is where the Department of Visual Arts on campus and computer science combined to develop a Center for Design Thinking. The goal, according to co-director Brandon Gellis, is to teach people how to bring engineering and design thinking concepts together.
An app is a perfect example on a phone of something that you need a computer scientist and a programmer to develop, but you also need something that looks really interesting and evocative and is intuitive.
The program is hoping to use students to develop entrepreneurial projects that can do a number of things, which includes solving some engineering issues in the state. Dean Pishko says these programs and others will certainly change the outlook for UW's engineering and computer science program.
I think it puts us on par with the kinds of facilities that you would see at places like Stanford or MIT.
Pishko says the reaction to the new facility has been fairly uniform. It's been wow. He says potential students have been incredibly impressed, and he expects that to pay dividends in the not-too-distant future. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
This summer, Walter Tribley took over as president of the Northern Wyoming Community College District. Tribley has 20 years of experience in higher education. Most recently, he was the president of Monterey Peninsula College in California. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler sat down with Tribley at Sheridan College to talk about his goals as he begins his new position.
Goal number one is to learn about our communities and our colleges. And so that is primarily a faculty-driven event, and certainly I need to hear from the communities. It will always be a goal, but a real intense focus on listening and learning about our district. We will always have the goal to maintain our fiscal solvency and our meet our budget targets. We have some projects that are ongoing, some construction projects that we need to see through and find funding for, in some cases like our health science building here on this campus. We are very strongly engaged in Wyoming Works, and we need to make sure that we get that off the ground and have that be successful for our non-traditional students that need us to retool and get back out in the job market. That's something that our legislature paved the way for us last year. We need to make good on that and hit the ground running there. Certainly need to work very closely with our faculty on the opportunities we have potentially to offer four-year degrees. That work will be ongoing. There's always things to work on, but as a student of higher education, I could say this is a really good district, and I intend to keep that legacy going.
And so you talked about the four-year degrees. I think after the legislative session, people were really interested in that opportunity. How close is the district coming to offering some of those four-year applied science degrees?
This state is really going to be served well by having greater access to four-year degrees. So there are no degrees sitting here on the table. This is something we have to and must and will be better when we work with our faculty. You know, what a degree is and how and what the components of a degree are, the courses and the makeup of the degree and the experience. That's uniquely a faculty-driven function. We're going to be working with them. There would be no sooner than next fall. That's a rough timeline.
Obviously, with coal and everything that's going on recently, especially in Gillette, economic diversification is becoming more and more important and more of a focus, not only with communities, but also with like the legislature. And so how do you envision the college's role in that, especially in this area where things like energy and manufacturing are really important to the economies?
Community colleges play a vital role, and not just philosophically, but with many, many cases that would be offered as evidence. They play a vital role in attracting a business to your community. When a business places its operations in a state, they need to see if it's going to be a favorable small business economy. Is the tax structure going to be favorable to business? And how are we going to get a steady stream of highly educated, trained employees? And your local community college does that. From your frontline office staff, or taking a look at our Gillette College or here at Sheridan College, all the career and technical education programs we have, machine tooling, diesel, welding, and many, many others, business. So you would be placing your business here in a state that has a favorable tax structure. It has a wonderful opportunity for you to hire well-trained employees and flexible community colleges that can, if the need is great enough, tailor educational programs to make sure that your unique workforce is trained. If there's a special skill and there's enough people that need it, we can adapt and adjust. And that's one real strength of the community college system, is that we can change and adapt faster than most higher education institutions, and we do. A higher education is really has shown to be very valuable, particularly in an uncertain economy. Those folks that have more education under their belt tend to do better when the economy takes a turn in a challenging direction. So I'm really excited, actually, about the opportunity for community colleges to be offering those four-year degrees. If we come upon ones that our faculty want and recommend, and we move forward with those would be really helpful, I think, for the state in general.
Dr. Walter Tribley is the new president of the Northern Wyoming Community College District. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much. I've really appreciated this interview.
When we come back, we will take you to a pair of trainings, one for students and another for educators, regarding guns in schools. This is Open Spaces.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Maggie Mullen.
And I'm Bob Beck. Some school districts in Wyoming and the rest of the region are considering whether or not school staff should be allowed to carry concealed guns for safety purposes. Before staff can do that, they need to go through a training program. In the first of two reports, the Mountain West News Bureau's Ray Ellen Bichelle followed along with a group at a weekend workshop in Colorado. And a warning for listeners, this story includes the sound of gunshots.
Instructor Graham Dunn is holding up some printouts with faces on them. He tells his students these are smaller than real heads.
So here's some useless knowledge from being a sniper. The average human head is 6 inches across by 10 inches high.
We're at a facility in Commerce City, Colorado. Usually the people training here are law enforcement. But today, they're teachers, principals, bus drivers, coaches, and school administrators. 13 of them.
So just to make it simple, pick one of the big heads to shoot. That's your target.
They're holding 9mm pistols, mostly Glocks. Dunn calls them the Toyota Corolla of guns. And they're about to use them to blast their targets. Dunn is going to shout out some scenarios.
All right, here we go. You know the drill. Put your hands up!
Put your hands up!
Don't move!
Don't move!
Okay, he's lifting up his shirt. He's pulling out a gun. 3 rounds. Fire! There you go. Good.
Next, the imaginary aggressor will have a knife instead of a gun. He gets the same treatment.
Put your hands up!
Don't move!
Don't move!
He's got a knife in his hand. He's walking towards you. 3 rounds. Fire! Move.
The group running this training is called Faster Colorado. About 200 school staff have gone through the program, mostly coming from 34 school districts across the state.
Very good. Nice work, guys.
One teacher has a Band-Aid on her hand from slamming in fresh magazines.
3, 4, 5. I don't know why I brought 1,000.
Looking through her bag, she guesses she's used 700 rounds this weekend.
700? Is that, did I add right?
She doesn't want to be named because she says then a school shooter might target her. That's an opinion shared by a lot of people in this class. Most didn't want to talk to me at all.
I'm probably going to stick to not answering any questions.
But Carl Donaldson was okay with it.
I'm Carl. Nice to meet you.
The science teacher says it would take almost half an hour for the sheriff to arrive at his small town high school.
My kids, my own kids are there. And I'm not going to stand there and throw a book at someone who's trying to kill our kids. And that's just a fact of it. And most of these gunfights are over in 2 or 3 minutes, and we can't sit around and wait for the police to get there, and it's going to be done.
Donaldson says he went through a psych evaluation, got his concealed carry permit, and went through a few trainings, including a version of this one last year. This is level 2, a refresher course required by his school district. They're about to wrap up lunch and divide into 2 groups.
5 plus 2, 7.
Okay, look, ready? 7?
One group enters a room. In it, there's something called the Forced Option Simulator.
So this is a simulation gun.
Instructor Paul Gregory explains how things will work.
The only thing that moves on this is the trigger.
It's a dark room with surround sound and a video projected onto the wall.
All right.
A trainee steps up. He's a school administrator. Gregory tells him what to expect.
You are in the hallway, and there's a school play practice going on. And as you're in the hallway, you hear some shots being fired from the auditorium. Okay. Okay.
The projection turns the wall into a school hallway.
There's a kid there with a gun. What's going on?
Students are running past. One is clutching his arm. We round the corner into the auditorium. It seems empty, quiet. There's a body crumpled between the seats. The trainee is pacing, shifting his weight from foot to foot, shoulders tense. And then the shooter stands up. The trainee fires 4 times. The shooter goes down, and the auditorium fades back into a wall.
Okay.
The instructors review the shots.
Here's shot number 1. He surprised you. 2, 3, 4.
Only 1 of the 4 rounds actually hit the shooter.
So 25% hit rate. Where do the other 3 shots go?
In that wall.
Yeah.
And what's behind the wall? The instructors have some bad news for the trainee.
It's the preschool.
Yeah. It's what?
It's the preschool.
It's the preschool?
Yes.
Okay.
And how many misses like this are acceptable, they say? The answer, of course, is none. For Guns in America and the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Ray Ellen Bichelle.
Another part of this has to do with training students how to react. For Guns in America, Lee Patterson went to an active shooter training at a school in northern Colorado, which focused on 3 actions: evacuate, barricade, and fight.
Standing on blue gym mats under bright fluorescent lights, a trainer and a student lean in, heads close.
Okay, so nice and low, athletic, like, you know, get your body weight into it. Slap, bear hug, straight down.
Now the student nods. Others watch from the bleachers and the gym floor.
Okay, ready? Here we go.
A man wearing knee and chest pads steps onto the mat. He's holding a fake orange gun. The student grabs him, takes him down. A bunch of other boys pile on top as the trainers, former SWAT team members, and other law enforcement officers give instructions. These high school students really do seem to be having fun, but they're preparing for a nightmare scenario, that there's an active shooter in the building. This particular exercise represents the fight part of evacuate, barricade, fight. The 3 steps that a company called TAC-1 is teaching at Pinnacle Charter School at its first ever active shooter training for students.
My name is Chad Miller. I'm Chief Executive Officer at Pinnacle Charter School.
Between training sessions, Miller and I talk in a classroom, sitting on small kid chairs. He says his thinking on preparedness has evolved over the years for a couple of reasons. First, there's community-level violence, stuff like guns, drugs, gangs. And 2 years ago, there was a mass shooting at a Walmart nearby. 3 people died. And then...
after the STEM shooting, that really changed things. That changed the game.
A school shooting, multiple injuries, this time outside Denver. And
2 students have been charged with opening fire at the STEM school in May, injuring 8 and killing 1. Kendrick Castillo, a student who tried to take down the shooter.
And there's some heroes in that situation. How many lives did they save by doing that?
Just days before the STEM shooting, a student at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, was also killed while trying to stop a gunman. So I asked Miller, given what happened at STEM, that the young man ultimately died rushing the shooter, why is fight a tactic he supports?
Hopefully the kids have options. Hopefully the kids can run away. Hopefully they can hide. Hopefully they can barricade. If they're in close proximity and they have no other options, here's what you're probably going to have to do, and here's how to do that.
TAC 1 has taught the evacuate, barricade, fight classes in 4 other schools in Wyoming and Arizona. But none of those students have then actually used those skills in an active shooter situation. And broadly, there's just not much data on how well these tactics actually work.
Is fighting the best thing to do?
In the gym, one of the trainers runs through the 3 options.
Is barricading the best thing to do? I want you to have choices. There's no one best thing to do.
After that fight training, I talked with 2 seniors, Brianna.
My name is Brianna Centeno.
And Giovanni.
This is Giovanni J. Medina Rico.
They both said they felt empowered with their new skills. Compared to other types of gun violence, mass shootings are rare, but for these 2, the possibility of having to fight is absolutely real.
If it was, you know, life or death, then, you know, I'm the one who only knows and I'm the leader, it's definitely something that I think I would have to do morally. Like, I feel like since we are the oldest in the school, I should look out for those that are younger than me and like weaker than me.
In talking about the young man who died tackling the shooter at the STEM school.
It just makes me feel emotional knowing about that. It's kind of hard to say, but like I would lay down my life if I had to protect my classmates. Because it just shows that I'm responsible in some way. It takes a lot of courage to and braveness to lay down your life just to protect someone, even if you have to go away.
After we talked, Brianna and Giovanni ate their lunches and then finished up their day of training. Now, it's back to regular high school stuff. Football, student council, and graduation at the end of the year. For Guns and America, I'm Lee Patterson.
On September 11, 2001, Sarah Lashbrook was teaching kindergarten in downtown Manhattan, just 3 blocks away from the World Trade Center. At StoryCorps in Jackson, her friend Jessica Sale Chambers asked Sarah what that morning was like.
I hear what sounds like the loudest thunder I had ever heard in my entire life. And I realized it wasn't thunder, and there was no rain. It was beautiful, beautiful, crystal clear blue sky day, and smoke and flames coming out of the tower.
Oh my God.
The North Tower. So we rounded up the 3 kindergarten classes that probably had, I think I had close to like 30-something students that day. And we went into the auditorium. When we were in the auditorium, the lights flickered and the building shook. I now know that that was the second tower that got hit, the South Tower. Pretty soon after, someone came in from the office and said, yeah, it's time to go. You gotta leave. And we were like, well, where are we supposed to go? They were like, you just need to go north. So we told all the children that we were going to leave the auditorium and we were going to go north. When we got into the stairwell, we saw a woman in SWAT gear. She was wearing all black SWAT gear and she was covered in white. And that was a big indicator. Like, that was like, okay, something's really not right.
Right.
And then we got outside and there was a woman in army fatigues and she was yelling at us like, move, move, move. Like, you gotta go, you gotta go. And I'm like, okay. Okay. Like, there was no order. It's like, we're moving quickly. We're crossing the street. You're, like, looking around to make sure you have the children that you, so you're not misplacing anyone or they're getting...
30 of them.
30 of them with other people. But then at the same time, what we noticed is that people from the towers in South were going north, too. So it was almost just like this... this, like, mass just, like, moving forward, and you're just, like, in it, and you're just moving. Like, you're not really thinking. One of them was, like, don't look back. But when someone says don't look back, you look back. And it was the second tower falling. Literally, like, crumbling. This, like, cloud of smoke was just, like, billowing up. It was, like, a... it was, like, crawling. It would come down, and then it would kind of, like, crest up like a circle, and it was like rolling. It was almost like rolling towards us. Ambulances, fire trucks, just sirens on the West Side Highway, like flying past us. And I just heard in the distance, PS 89, turn here. And I was like, oh, that's us. Okay. We had made it all the way up to Christopher Street. But then we had to cross the street, which was a highway. There obviously weren't any cars, like traffic, but it was emergency vehicles.
Right.
Because we had to like run across the street. And then we stepped into the West Village and it was quiet and it was eerie. And
was it still bright? Was there still all this stuff in the air?
No, it was bright. It was bright, light, quiet street.
Yeah.
People just standing still, like mouths open, just staring at TVs. My life was never the same. You know, they say, like, never forget.
Right.
But how do you even begin to explain?
Friends Sarah Lashbrook and Jessica Sell Chambers at StoryCorps in Jackson, remembering the morning of 9/11. Alex Schaefer produced this piece.
When we come back, we'll go to Sheridan, where they are celebrating 30 years of an important performing arts center, and UW's Western Thunder Marching Band goes to Riverton. This is Open Spaces.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Maggie Mullen.
And I'm Bob Beck. Since the 1920s, the Wyo Theater in Sheridan has been a place for the community to experience the performing arts. This month, the theater is celebrating its birthday after nearly having been demolished 30 years ago. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler reports on how the Wyo came to be.
The Wyo Theater in Sheridan, as people know it today, almost didn't exist. And that might be surprising, since it's one of the biggest highlights of the city's downtown. The Wyo Theater opened up in 1923 as the Lotus. It played talkies and became a movie theater for a good portion of the 20th century. But in the 1980s, its then-owner moved on to a different venue. That left the Wyo in disrepair. But a group of community members wanted a place in Sheridan to experience the performing arts. So they decided to do something about it. Aaron Butler is the Wyo's executive director.
They saw that there was a need for this particular kind of entertainment facility here in Sheridan, and so they formed a group called Save the Wyo.
The group's goal was to raise awareness about the building and the money to save it.
So the city saw that there was actually interest and that these people were working very hard to save this old historic building. So they bought the Wyo. And then leased it back to what was then Save the Wyo Inc. for something like $10 a year.
The building reopened in 1989, and this month, the theater is celebrating its 30th birthday. Pat Tomsevic, who was part of the Save the Wyo group in the 80s, remembers the week it opened back up.
We had some seats, but we really didn't have any lights. So it was sort of a dark performance, you know, and the lobby was barely done and the dressing rooms were sort of non-existent. And so it just opened with the bare minimum.
Dick Davis was also a part of that group and remembers after the initial opening, they still had things to be concerned about.
Then we had to worry about how you keep the doors open and raising the money for the ongoing operations.
And since, the Wyo has had to work hard to keep the lights on, but that hasn't prevented the theater from growing. Within the last decade, the theater worked with the city and the college to raise money, get grants, and take over the neighboring historic buildings to expand its offerings. In addition to its original main stage, the Wyo now has the Mars Black Box Theater, classrooms for Sheridan College, rehearsal spaces, expanded stage wings, a community costume area, a new box office, and office space. Pat Tomsevic, who was there when the building was near demolition, says being in the Wyo today is surreal.
I'm a Sheridan girl. I'm born and raised here, and so I'm sitting in what used to be Sweetbriar Clothing Shop, and right next door was Oswald's Jewelry, and I've seen this theater grow. Now it's part of this huge performing arts complex.
The whole space is now known as the Wyo Performing Arts and Education Center. Butler, the executive director, says the goal is to broaden the definition of performing arts.
I think it's changed the way people perceive performing arts. Because they've come to the Wyo and had different experiences, they feel more ownership of the space, and then they can perhaps feel more comfortable coming to something they wouldn't otherwise attend.
Tomsevic says the community's support of the Wyo has always been crucial.
If you've worked in theater a lot, you know that performing artists who come in charge a lot of money, and we never make money on that. You know, the money to keep the Wyo Theater open has to come from lots of other places, people who sponsor the shows, and then generous benefactors, and Sheridan is lucky that way.
Chairman of the Wyo's board, Gene Sterlin, adds,
"The Wyo is actually the gem of the downtown. Night after night, weekend after weekend, something is going on in the Wyo, and it is generally something, you know, that is enlightening or entertaining, and someone's learning something, and someone's coming away smiling, and someone is happier when they leave than when they got there."
Which isn't bad. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Catherine Wheeler in Sheridan.
The University of Wyoming marching band Western Thunder took a trip to Riverton last Friday to perform at the high school football game. The event, called Bring the Thunder, is part of an effort to get students excited about going to college and to recruit new members of the marching band. Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr was there to see the two bands meet, and she sent us this postcard.
My name is Hannah Finn. I'm a junior at Riverton High School, and I play alto saxophone. And I've lived here in Riverton my entire life. So tonight we have the Western Thunder Marching Band from the University of Wyoming coming to play with us. And at the high school, we'll be doing our pep band songs during the football game. Western Thunder will be playing during halftime. And it's just super, super cool that we get to have the big university band come play at a small town here with us.
Yeah, so Western Thunder Marching Band is in Riverton for the Riverton High School football game versus Cody High School. A little bit of outreach for us to get around the state and kind of showcase what we do in Laramie. From band to band, you know, it's great for us to kind of showcase what options are available to younger music students at the next level. We're hoping that these kids love playing in the band here at Riverton, and they come and bring their instrument down to Laramie when they come to college, and they can be in this band one day.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome your 2019 Riverton Wolverines. Number one, 5'10", 145-pound senior, Brennan Eyeball.
No downbeat. My name is Standal Koski, head band director here at Riverton High School. Essentially band director, music teacher, general life coach, and occasionally babysitter. Jasmine, put those down. I don't want nacho cheese on my drum.
Go!
They call it the jank chord. It's a means to distract either the kicker or the receiver. Just a little bit of mental warfare coming from the home team. The most raucous noise you can think of. I don't know, did it work?
The score is 0-7. You didn't hear this from me, but we did not win a game last year. But before that, we were really good. So I don't know what happened, and we're just trying to get that back.
Red, 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 red. White, 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 white.
We play clarinet. Yeah, so we're hanging out with these nice clarinet folks over here.
One, three, one, two, ready, play.
I started back in 2012 playing the clarinet, and this is my senior year of college, so my eighth year marching band. Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't stop being in band. It's the best decision I ever made.
Just keep on being in band, even if you like think it's something that it's not something that you want to continue. You might not have time. Make the time for it. Music can be a real solace in life, and especially like clarinet is some of the most fun. But in all seriousness, like any kind of music you can keep in your life, in any kind, whether it's just listening to music, playing music, going to concerts, you always should just keep it in your life constantly.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the field for your halftime enjoyment, the 2019 Western Thunder Marching Band.
Savannah Marr is a Report for America Corps member.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. If you missed part of the show or want to hear it again, you can find it on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just click on Open Spaces. You can also get the program via podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. Today's fill-in is Mary Grace Bedwell.
Bringing you this high-quality, award-winning news program is not free. It takes dedicated reporters and the resources to get them across the state and the equipment to bring you interesting stories. Please support our Wyoming news coverage with your pledge today. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.